the reins and held them exactly as Goblin liked. The horse moved quietly out of the inn yard. Colonel Smith's face disappeared from the parlor window. "Lydia," said Johnny as he strolled over to the washerwoman, "I'll help you with those clothes." She gave him a dazzling smile. "My land, Johnny boy, I could do with a bit of help. Them Britishers expect a clean sheet every week and seems like a clean shirt every day." Johnny gravely pinned a couple of shirts on the line, his mouth, like Lydia's, full of wooden clothespins. The ruffled shirts began snapping smartly in the breeze. "Sheets?" "We've got 17 officers staying with us. We've got sheets by the dozen." "Look, Lydia, you lend me a sheet for just a few moments. If I get it dirty, I'll wash it, and besides, I'll hang up every sheet in your basket." "Boy, I don't know what you're up to, and I suspect no good." "You'll do as I say?" "If it's that Lieutenant Stranger what's took your horse away from you, I'll do plenty. He wants to commandeer Goblin for his colonel." "We? Don't know, commandeer, but it sounds dreadful cruel to me."
"It is a way you cook things," said Johnny soberly.
"My land, boy, don't you let them cook that pretty horse of yours." "I'll cook them first. Now, look, we've got to stand fairly near to the driveway like this. You get on that end of the sheet, and I on this, and we'll let her fill up with wind. Wait, he's coming back. So, now let go, Lydia. Quick, let go." The sheet bellied out like a sail when Lydia let go. Goblin, quickly recognizing Stranger's skill and goodwill, had behaved admirably. The lieutenant thought he'd advise his colonel to pay a pretty fancy price for such a choice beast. Colonel Smith, a timid horseman, liked showy mounts. This one was showy, all right, with his strange pale coat and mane and tail like mahogany. He was young and high-strung. Stranger believed he himself would have to ride him for the next month to get him gentle enough for his superior. But his gaits were like dancing. "Let me see," he was thinking. "I'll offer long..." And then the whole earth blew up from under him and hit him a terrific blow on his seat. There was a splash as well. He had landed in a mud puddle. The horse was disappearing into the stable. He got up, ruefully looked at his white breeches, shrugged, and walked over to where Johnny was diligently pinning up sheets. Both he and Lydia had their backs discreetly turned.
"Well..." he said to Johnny belligerently.
"Yes, sir."
"I'd already noticed your horse worries a bit over blown paper in the streets, things like that. I suppose you know that, too."
"Yes, sir." "Take those damned clothespins out of your mouth and turn around and answer me."
Once the clothespins were out of his mouth, it was hard not to laugh.
"Answer you what, sir?"
"You flapped that sheet on purpose, just for the fun of seeing me sit in a puddle and...
and to keep my horse out of the army."
"Oh, you,"
said Stranger, pretending to be angry, but Johnny knew that at heart he was not. Colonel Smith's great red face once more appeared.
"How'd he ride, Lieutenant? Gad, sir, what? Where's the horse, sir? What have you been mucking about in?"
"Mud puddles, sir. I fell off."
He made no effort to excuse himself.
"Beast vicious, eh?"
"No, sir, just a mite jumpy. No good for army work, nor even just hacking about Boston."
"But that damn boy, how does he manage?"
"It's his horse, sir."
"Thanks, Lieutenant, you can look elsewhere for me."
The head went in. Stranger was stretching himself lightly.
"I'll drink my beer standing up for a few days," he said to no one in particular.
Then, as an afterthought,
"Beer. Hi, kitchen," he yelled.
In the arrogant way, Johnny noticed the young officers always called for service.
"Two tankards of beer, out here in the yard."
He turned to Johnny.
"What's your horse's name?"
"Goblin."
"We'll drink to Goblin. Potboy, give that tankard to this young man. You know, of course, there's no real cure for a horse that shies as badly as that."
"I've been told he'll never be gentle."
"If he was as good as he looks, I'd hate to guess what he'd be worth."
"As it is, I'd not give 15 shillings for him, except,"
and he smiled suddenly. "For myself to ride. Have you schooled him in jumping?"
"No, we're not fancy riders over here. At the foot of the common you'll find a series of hurdles we've put up. If happens you're over there sometime when I am, I'll show you a bit."
"Thank you, sir."
"Does he still throw you sometimes?"
"Sometimes.
I'd have gone off fast enough when that sheet let loose."
"That sheet? Yes, that was a trick. That was good. That was fine. Hi, you black wench. You finish this beer for me and take the tankards back to the kitchen."
And off he stalked, still chuckling to himself. Beginning with that day when Goblin had tumbled Lieutenant Stranger in the mud, Johnny had no more trouble with the British stable boys. When it became hard for him to get the oats and hay for Goblin, they told him he might use theirs. But Dove, who was always swearing allegiance to England, and Johnny knew that he was honestly a Tory, was the butt of all their jokes. Dove clung to Johnny like a drowning man, and Johnny did protect him. He could not help himself. So Dove began oozing into his life. He spent most of his free time at the Observer's office and was always complaining, always gorging himself on the scarce food, and bored both Johnny and Rab. But, Rab said, and Johnny knew this was true, sometime the British would not stay tamely shut up in Boston. Sometime they'd strike out and seize the military supplies they knew the provincials were collecting. A colonel's horseboy might very well know a day or so, or even a few hours before a colonel marched. It was up to Johnny to keep in touch with Dove. It was all right for Rab to talk. Rab was training with the armed forces. But what could Johnny do? Not much, it seemed to him, except be bored to death for his country. 4. As he came back from Milton, riding the long, lonely stretch of the neck, with the gallows and the town gate still before him, Johnny realized how long ago it was that he had burned his hand, and how he had hated Dove when he found out the part he had played in that accident. How he had sworn to get even with him, the lying hypocrite, telling old Mr. Lapham that all he meant to do was to teach a pious lesson. Now, as he saw Dove daily about the Afric Queen, he could hardly remember this feeling of hatred, his oaths of vengeance. Seemingly hatred and desire for revenge did not last long. He had made new friends. The old world of the Lapham shop and house was gone, yet he remembered old Mr. Lapham, who had died that spring, with more affection than when he had been serving under him. Even Mrs. Lapham now did not seem so bad. Poor woman, how she had struggled and worked for that good, plentiful food, the clean shirts her boys had worn, the scrubbed floors, polished brass. No, she had never been the ogress he had thought her a year ago. There never had been a single day when she had not been the first up in the morning. He, like a child, had thought this was because she liked to get up. Now he realized that there must have been many a day when she was as anxious to lie abed as Dove himself. He remembered when there was no money to buy meat, and how she would go from stall to stall until she found a butcher who would accept payment by a new clasp on his pocketbook, or a fishwife who would exchange a basket of salt herrings for a black mourning ring. Her bartering and bickering had then seemed small-minded to him. Now he was enough older to realize how valiantly she had fought for those under her care. True, Madge would make another of those big-fisted, hearty women. But women can be worse than that, he thought with some pity of Dorcas and her craving for elegance. Was she never, no, not once, to eat off china? Always nothing but pewter? Poor girl. She'd not live too high with Frizzell Jr. But Johnny wished her well. Priscilla Lapham. Ever since Rab had taken her home and left Johnny to eat 6 fried eggs by himself, he had felt differently about Scylla. She had been his best friend during the years he worked at the Laphams, and then for some months she had been a drag on him. He had not bothered much with her. Overnight, that had changed. He was always looking forward to Thursdays and the seed cakes and the half-hour sitting out under the fruit trees with Scylla. And sometimes he would see Miss Lavinia Light. Then Johnny would hold his breath a moment and enjoy the chill that went up his spine. His feelings for Izana had changed, too, and not for the better. It would break Scylla's heart if the little girl did not live up to her lovely face. But But Johnny had not liked it, that last Thursday when he had been sitting on the back stoop with Scylla and Miss Lavinia had driven up on her smart whiskey with a redcoat beside her, and Azana wedged in between. It could not be possible Azana had not seen him. But she had glanced at him, and then looked away. Johnny rode through the town gates, telling his business to the British sentries there, then went first to report to Paul Revere. A family of Tories in Milton wished to move into Boston, and had written Colonel Smith about this move. Although a great many of the Whig families were moving out of the town, a great many Tories, frightened by the rough treatment they were getting in the inland towns, were moving in to be under the protection of the British troops. Then, as he had been thinking about the Laphams all the way over from Roxbury, Johnny decided to stop in and see them. He had not been in this house once since Mrs. Lapham and Mr. Tweedy had been so ready to cast him off for the sake of Mr. Light's patronage. The Squeak Pig was alone in the shop. He had not so much as one boy to help him with his fires or to sweep his shop. He liked to work alone. Johnny saw that he was mending the silver hilt of a British officer's sword. "What are you doing here?" he muttered crossly at Johnny. Johnny took off his spurs and showed the silversmith a broken rowel. "I want you to fix that for me this afternoon, Mr. Silversmith." "Yes, sir." "Yes, indeed." Once Johnny was a patron, the past was forgiven him. "If you'll take a chair, it shall be mended in 15 minutes." Johnny couldn't help it. He said proudly, "In 10 minutes, Mr. Silversmith." "In 10 minutes, sir." He walked into the kitchen. There was nobody about, but he could smell bread rising. He looked in the birth and death room. It was once more used for storage. It seemed strange beyond belief that he had ever lain so long in the room. And in a way he had died in that room. At least something had happened, and the bright little silversmith's apprentice was no more. He stood here again at the threshold. But now he was somebody else. Then he went outside to the little backyard with the coal house, the privy, and the old willow. Underneath the willow sat a British sergeant of marines with Madge Lapham in his arms. He had rather guessed the Laphams would side with the Tories, but this was fraternizing with the troops at a great rate. The sergeant was not half as big as Madge, but he was holding her in his lap. It is hard to hold even a small child very long in such a position. Johnny thought the sergeant must be very tough. They heard his feet and both looked up at him. Johnny laughed, as did the sergeant and Madge. She said, "Just so it isn't Mother," and she twisted and yearned down into her small lover's eyes. "The bigger they come," thought Johnny, "the harder they fall. Madge certainly likes that sergeant." And, "Sergeant, dear," she said, "I'd like to make you acquainted with an old friend of the family. But, Johnny, how you have grown! I don't know whether to introduce you as Johnny or Mr. Tremaine." Johnny had grown. Much of the last year had been spent out of doors and on horseback, and now he was always out in the sun and wind. "Just Johnny." "Sergeant Gale, dear, this is Johnny Tremaine." They both agreed they were glad to meet. Gale, whose legs must have been badly cramped, picked up Madge as though she were a pet cat and sat her down beside him. The little man must be prodigiously strong, thought Johnny, and he liked his ugly, lined face. He looked just about as tough as they come, even in the Marines. Madge, whom he had always liked the least of the Lapham girls, was rosy, glowing, and beaming. He had always heard that love was a wonderful thing. If it could make Madge Lapham so pleasant, he was ready to agree. "Sit down, Johnny, and tell us about yourself." "There's not much to say. I'm making out." "Isn't Izana in luck? Taken right into the family like a little sister." "Like a pet poodle dog," Johnny said firmly. "My, you haven't changed much. You always were sort of jumping on other people." "I still jump. How's Mrs. L?"
"Don't mention her," said Sergeant Gale.
"Ma says I've got to marry Mr. Tweedy. He doesn't want to, and I don't want to." "Oh, Johnny, you're too young to understand, and I guess Ma's so old she's forgotten. I can't marry Mr. Tweedy, not since I met Sergeant Gale."
I'll say not, said the Marine. Madge, in case you've been wondering, is going to marry me. Aren't you, you toothsome, plump suet pudding?
The skinny little red rascal evidently liked his lady's plump. Johnny went back to the shop, paid Mr. Tweedy for his work, and buckled on his spurs. He had enjoyed his visit to the Laphams. Mr. Tweedy had bowed to him, called him sir, and rubbed his hands in gratitude for even this small favor. Madge, so pleasant, and the smell of Ma's good bread rising. Goblin, tied to the head of the wharf, was pawing, turning toward him and nickering. As he settled himself in the saddle and the horse moved off down Fish Street, he thought it had been a nice visit. But he would not go again. That was all over. 5. Mrs. Bessie, that monstrous fine woman who cooked for the Lights, always had an eye out Thursday afternoons for Johnny, and she usually could manage that Scylla was free then, for she was housekeeper as well as cook. This Thursday, as Johnny drew up, she shook her head.
You come on in, Johnny, but I guess today you'll have to put up with just me. Your little sweetheart,
Johnny's stomach turned over,
will be needed in the parlor. We've got 9 or 10 of those British officers in there, and Miss Lavinia wants to put on a good show for them.
Johnny had often noticed before how disrespectfully Mrs. Bessie spoke of Lavinia. And she was always telling Scylla that she needn't jump so fast when the bell rang for her.
Let her blow her own nose for once, she'd say.
Johnny knew that it was no good omen that the old woman had no loyalty toward her mistress, whom she had known since her motherless infancy. In his heart he knew there was something unlikable about Lavinia Light. Mrs. Bessie knew what it was, and Scylla now knew, but she wouldn't tell him. Now, when he wanted to talk about Miss Light, she would veil her eyes and look at him from out of the corners and say nothing. But he knew, Scylla knew.
All they in the parlor are fixing to go up to a ball at the Province House General Gage is giving tonight. Masquerade. Miss Lavinia is going like the Black Queen of Spades, and all her special admirers are going as kings or knaves or jokers out of the pack. Izana's going, too.
Izana?
Yep. Where Miss goes these days, that child goes, too. Izzy.
No one had ever before called the little girl this.
Goes dressed as a two-spot, holding up Miss Lavinia's train.
Scylla shot into the kitchen looking bright and excited.
Johnny, I thought you might be here. They're trying to make a scepter for the Queen of Spades out of tin. I told them you could do it. Miss Lavinia said show him in.
The elegant dove-gray, lavender-and-yellow drawing-room was in what Mrs. Lapham would call a state. The officers seemed to have counted on their lady's help with their costumes. But they had also brought with them a military tailor who was sitting cross-legged on the floor, stitching out a black-and-yellow-striped jerkin for a knave. Miss Lavinia looked half in and half out of her costume as Queen of Spades. For a moment, Johnny was confused. It was not because she had less clothing on than he was accustomed to, but because she was so beautiful. He had never seen her so happy, so animated before. She was laughing hilariously as she attempted to fasten 2 flat surfaces of cardboard painted with 2 spots onto Izana. But Izana had on nothing but her undershift, her little pink legs bare to the middle thigh. Ma would die if she saw her daughter like this. Johnny did not care about that, but he could not bear to think of poor old Mr. Lapham turning over in his grave. Johnny paid no attention to the hilarious Miss Light. He went up to Izana. Look here, girl, you go upstairs and you put some clothes on.
Izana stared at him, her beautiful, soft brown eyes so blank she looked almost blind.
You know your grandpa's just about flopping over and over in his grave. You weren't brought up to act like this.
Izana said, I'm too young to be lascivious.
She was evidently repeating what she had heard some adults say. Johnny slapped her. Not for himself, but for her grandpa. She went down in a heap, upended over a pile of finery brought down from the attic. While standing up, it was possible she did not have on quite enough clothes for mixed company, but upended she did not look to have on any. Then everyone began to laugh. Lavinia was wiping her eyes. Lieutenant Stranger, for it was he who picked the child up, was reduced to painful gasps.
Oh!
There was a major in a corner who was vowing he was going to die. Only the military tailor never lifted his eyes, but went on with his stitching.
"Oh, Johnny," Miss Lavinia managed at last, for the first time calling him by name. "Will you come to the ball and slap all the ladies you think are undressed?" "Oh, la! I've burst a stay string. Give me Scylla fetched."
Scylla evidently knew what would be wanted. She came running with smelling salts, but she got it too close to her mistress's nose. Miss Lavinia was gagging.
"Oh, you stupid, stupid girl! You've half killed me. There, take it away."
Izana ran up and hid her flushed face in Miss Lavinia's lap. She was half frightened at the attention she had been receiving, and half squirming with delight at being the center of so many eyes. As Miss Lavinia was scolding one sister for a clumsy servant, she was fondling the flying, soft yellow hair of the other. Suddenly, Johnny saw red. He hated Miss Lavinia and the giggling officers and Izana. He had already guessed that the two sisters were treated very differently, but he had not before actually seen the situation with his own two eyes. Scylla had backed out of the picture, standing aside ready to serve if called upon, or ready to be of no more importance than a piece of furniture if not spoken to. Johnny went to her. "Scylla," he said, "don't you stay here anymore. I don't want you to. These people are nothing. Just a pack of playing cards. Tear them up and get out. And that goes for the whole collection of them, Miss Lavinia and Izzy, too." Miss Light had regained her composure.
I will not have Izana called Izzy by my servants."
"I'm not your servant, and if she acts like an Izzy, she gets called Izzy. But as I was saying, Scylla..."
"I will not have my servants intruding their personal affairs into my drawing room."
"Priscilla, if you are not satisfied here, I can arrange for your return to your mother, but you are not ever to bring in street boys, horse boys, riff-raff."
"You told me to fetch him in."
"I did not tell you to fetch him in."
"Yes, you did."
"I said a clever metal worker, and you came back with this boy, this saucebox, who couldn't do the work anyway because he..."
Johnny waited grimly for her to finish her sentence. If she dared say what was in her mind, "because he has a crippled hand,"
he was going over and take her by her long throat and shake her, even if she did look pretty well defended by His Majesty's forces. Her eyes wavered, and she did not finish her sentence.
"Now, Scylla, I want you to go to your room and lie down. You are too tired. If you had not been, you would never have been so impudent as to contradict me."
"Yes, Miss Light." "And you," she turned to Johnny, "get back to the gutter or wherever boys like you keep themselves."
"Yes, Miss Light," he said, mimicking Scylla.
Mrs. Bessie said nothing, but she evidently knew what had been going on in the drawing room.
"There, Johnny," she said mildly, "you sit. This is not real tea, but I've put just a mite of brandy in it, and it's good and hot."
"Miss Lavinia is just about making a monkey out of Izana," he said at last.
"Nobody can make a monkey out of anyone who isn't a monkey to start with."
"Is Scylla happy here?"
"Oh, happy enough. What do you expect? She knows she's lost Izana. At first she used to cry, but now she accepts it. It's exciting for her, and there's always a flurry and goings-on. The ball tonight, and next week we move out to Milton for the rest of the summer. We won't stay long."
"Why?"
"Because the Sons of Liberty there are out to get Mr. Light. That's why they haven't yet been rough with the Tories out there. Hope to tempt him to move out, same as usual. They're going to get him and tar and feather him. They are going to ride Miss Lavinia out of town on a rail. They are going to smash his great country house down, once he's inside."
"But the girls, won't they get hurt?"
"I'll be there. It's my secret, so I suppose I can tell you. But I'd take it kindly if you'll keep your mouth shut. If there were daughters of Liberty, I'd be one. You ask Sam Adams about me. I've been helping him secretly for years."
Johnny had taken it for granted that an old servant in a Tory house would also be a Tory. They usually were. He looked at Mrs. Bessie with admiration.
"The Lights will stay in Milton about a month," she whispered.
You mark my words.
Chapter 8. A World to Come. It was by chance Johnny saw the lights ruby coach trundling down Orange Street, heading for Milton and a little country air. The bright sun glittered on the gold eye rising on the coach door, on the black sheen of the strong horses. He half wanted to stop the coach. "Don't you go to Milton, Miss Light. They are lying in wait for you out there." He could not bear to think of her tossed about by rough men, ridden on a rail. He could see her profile through the window. Scylla sat facing her. Izana, as befitted her higher station in the household, sat next to Miss Light. Only Izana was staring about, observing the lower classes milling about in the street. She looked straight at Johnny and he at her. Neither gave any sign of recognition. It was not by chance Johnny next saw that ruby coach. Late in August, word was spread through Boston that Merchant Light had got it, or was going to get it, out in Milton. If driven from their country house, there was but one safe refuge for them, behind the British lines in Boston. Toward evening, Johnny began to hang about the gate. The farm carts carrying food and fuel to Boston were still coming in over the mudflats connecting the town with the mainland. These the British guard at the gate, nearly 200 men, were kept stationed there night and day, let pass, but when night really fell, the gates were closed, and most of the soldiers returned to the barracks. There were a few sentries on duty and a handful of men, with a corporal, in the guardhouse. Johnny settled down to wait. He had been dozing, but woke quickly, hearing the sentries yell and the corporal commanding the gates to be opened. Then, coming closer through the still summer night, the clatter of hooves, the rumble of a coach, was a sickening, hair-raising howl. The howling of a human wolf pack. The corporal had not had time to get his tunic on, but he recognized the situation. Another of His Majesty's loyal supporters fleeing to Boston with the mob at its heels.
"Torches only!" he was crying to his men. "No muskets! Death to any man who fires!"
The unarmed soldiers ran out to meet the coach with great flaring torches in their hands. The mob had already stopped, was drifting back from whence it came. Through the canopy of shaking orange light and through the smell of burning pitch, black horses, whitened with lather and dragging a heavy ruby coach, slowly crawled to the safety of the gates. The gates shut behind them. The coach seemed disabled. The horses were almost spent. A torch flared up onto the coachman's face. It was twisted with fear.
"Mr. Light yourself, sir," the young corporal was saying, as he opened the door of the coach. "Let me assist you, sir. You've lost a wheel off your coach. Please to come into the guardhouse while you wait for another vehicle."
Mr. Light, helped by the corporal, but even more by Miss Lavinia, did crawl from the coach. He tried to smile, but his lips drew back from the long yellow teeth. Johnny had seen the identical expression on the face of a dead woodchuck. He was a desperately sick man. Lavinia's face showed no fear, only concern over her father's condition. Now she was telling the corporal that a doctor must be fetched, and she wanted Dr. Warren.
"I know he's a rebel, but do get him for me. He's the best doctor we have in town, and Papa must have the best."
Her father safely inside the guardhouse, Miss Lavinia came into the street a moment, gazing blankly at the disabled coach and at the men carrying from it into the guardhouse such of their most precious possessions as they had had time to rescue from Milton. For the first time, Johnny saw Scylla. She had been sitting on the box with the coachman. Now she went to Miss Light.
"Somehow," she said, "the silver got left behind."
"The silver?"
Miss Light did not seem to be able to take in anything but her father's sickness.
"You told me to pack it up, but just as I had begun, we heard the mob coming, and then Mr. Light had a fit."
"Oh, yes, I remember. All that silver. Well..."
She was standing there in the street, watching for the sight of Dr. Warren's chaise. Izana, very good and quiet, was snuggled close to her, her hand in that of her patroness.
"Oh, never mind, child," she said, with absent-minded kindness. "At least, we are all safe, and if only Papa is well, and..."
"I'm going back to Milton, miss, to get that silver before the riffraff steal it."
"Most like they have it already."
Dr. Warren's chaise was drawing up beside the guardhouse. He was getting out. Miss Lavinia had no more thought of her silver. Johnny went up to Scylla. "Look, Syl," he said. "I'm here." It was so mixed up in the end. The girl seemed to be trying to explain her error more to herself than to Johnny. Mr. Light turned purple and fell, and the mob was getting closer. It came earlier than Mrs. Bessie warned us.
Mrs. Bessie?
Yes, she found out some way in the village. Johnny liked the old woman all the better that in the end she had been unable to see a considerate master, whom she had served for 30 years, a young woman whom she had taken care of since she was a baby, humiliated, tossed about, torn by a mob. Sam Adams might respect her the less for this weakness. Johnny respected her the more. "Johnny, I've got to get back to Milton. I'm going to save that silver. It was my fault."
"But Miss Lavinia didn't seem to care. She didn't scold you."
"If she had, I wouldn't go. She thinks it's been stolen already." "No. After smashing the gates and some windows, the mob left the house to chase us. We didn't dare leave by the front drive. We started out through the haying fields, but they heard us and caught up, and we were getting away all right until just on the neck a wheel came off the coach. It was terrible. I've got to get back, though, and now."
"I'll go with you, but looks like we'll need a horse and chaise. It's 7 miles.
Dr. Warren was standing on the guardhouse steps, telling Miss Light that her father must be allowed to finish the night out on the bed the soldiers had made up for him. He was not to be moved, and never again must he be so upset over anything. From now on, as long as he lived, as she loved him, he was never to be angered or worried. The handsome girl was nodding, promising these impossible things. She went back to her father, still clutching Izana by the hand, and Johnny went to the doctor. Obviously, Dr. Warren did not want to lend his horse and chaise. He did not care what happened to the light silver, but he was a generous man. He let Johnny have his rig and also wrote him a pass which would prevent any molestation from the Whig mobs, and told Scylla to get a similar pass from the British soldiers. Then they would be safe from either side. So at last the gates once more swung slowly, heavily, in. Beyond was darkness and a dreary waste of land and sea. The doctor's little rabbit-eared mare flung herself forward. It would not take such a fast pacer long to get to Milton. 2. Although once or twice the light chaise slurred as it caught in great ruts made by the disabled light coach, there was no other sign of the late violence. The mob was utterly gone. It was not until they reached Roxbury that they knew the time. The village clock struck 2. Thus far they had not met one single human being, but here were a few turbulent fellows hanging about an inn door, and in Milton itself they were signaled to stop by a group whose faces they never did see. But Dr. Warren's chaise and horse were recognized.
"Go ahead, Warren. Good luck, Warren."
They went up the street road from Milton. It was here Mr. Light had his country seat. Then Johnny got out, struck tinder, and lighted the lantern he had found in the chaise. He stood by the entrance gates. Yes, Scylla was right. They had smashed the arms carved upon the gates. The poor people of Milton had had enough of that rising eye. Johnny wasn't sure, but he had as well. He walked ahead, and Scylla drove the horse. Thus half seen, and in the dark, things did not look too bad. Scylla had a key to the back door which showed hatchet marks, but was not broken down. They went into the dining room, and from the lantern Scylla lit the candles in the 2 candelabra on the table, 20 candles in all, and the room filled with light. Fear had overcome the lights as they had sat down to eat. Bread broken and never eaten. The roast of beef, with Yorkshire pudding sticking in the cold gravy. A bowl of salad was still fresh. Wine in the slender goblets. Already the great house did not seem to have been abandoned for a few hours only, but for years. It was as if a witchcraft had been worked upon it. Johnny saw that Scylla had started to get the silver together. "Where's Mrs. Bessie?" "She left earlier than we did, in a farm cart, but, you know, she'll be all right." Scylla went to work packing the silver, and she built up a little fire on the kitchen hearth so she might have hot water to wash the dishes. Neat by nature, she would leave the house tidy. Johnny took the lantern he had left on the kitchen table and walked through the silent house. He could see that every window in the lower floor had been broken, but no one had entered. He went upstairs, Lavinia's room, and strewed about it things he had never seen before. Stays, kerchiefs, patchboxes, ribbons, fripperies. It smelled faintly of lavender. He went to Mr. Light's room. The great four-poster soared to the ceiling. A damask dressing gown and Mr. Light's best wig on a wig rest. Off the big chamber and one step down was a smaller room designed as a dressing room. Mr. Light seemingly had used this as an office. Here was his desk, and above it a painting of his favorite ship, the Unicorn. And here, judging by the tipped-over chair and the rumpled rugs, Mr. Light had had his all-but-fatal fit. It had caught him as he had been packing his more important papers, papers he wished no one to see. Johnny picked up what looked like a leather-bound book. It had been hollowed out, turned into a box. In a bookcase, no one would suspect it. He glanced at the papers within. Every one of them, he saw, Sam Adams would be thankful to get. These he put in his pocket. Other books were scattered on the floor. Johnny picked up a heavy Bible, hoping that this, too, would prove to be a box. He put it on the desk and opened it. There were sheets of paper between the Old and New Testaments. Here a man might write his genealogy. So, the first Jonathan Light had been born in Kent in 16-something, and he had married a Matilda-something. Had come to Boston and had four sons and three daughters, and they, all seven, had sons and daughters and so on. Now he was coming to the generation in which he might expect to find his own mother. Here, indeed, was Merchant Light himself and his daughter Lavinia, the two sons who had drowned at Guadalupe, the girls dead in infancy. He even found that Aunt Bert, who had stayed on at Boston with her own servant. He found one Lavinia Light after another. One married an Endicott and one an Otis. Neither was the right age for his mother. Scratched out in such a way, he had at first thought it was a mere decoration on the elaborately written page. There was another name. It was Lavinia Light. He held the lantern closer. Born 1740. Married to Dr. Charles Latour, both of whom had died of plague in Marseille shortly before his own birth. His mother had told him he had been born in France and that his father had died before his own birth. But why Dr. Charles Latour? And why had his mother's name been scratched off the family record? But nevertheless, this was the spot, the very spot where he might hang his own few meager leaves to the light tree. Although in his daydreaming he had often pictured himself a nephew, grandnephew, or even a grandson of Merchant Light, he had never once believed the relationship was that close. Now he checked over the generations. His grandfather, Roger Light, dead now for 20 years and builder of this very house, had been the younger brother of Jonathan Light. Johnny himself was the merchant's grandnephew. He took his knife from his pocket and cut the pages from the family Bible. Sometime they might be of use to him. Scylla was calling him. She wanted him to help her carry the heavy boxes and hampers of silver to the chaise. On the sideboard, as yet unpacked, stood the four standing cups of the lights. "Which one is yours, Johnny?" He looked them over carefully. Only a silversmith could have told them apart. The base of one had been ever so little bent and straightened again. "This is my cup. Take it now." "No." He set it down and turned restlessly to Scylla. He could not say to anyone what went through his mind, not to Scylla, not even to himself. He acted and spoke blindly. "It's no good to me. We've moved on to other things." "But it isn't stealing to take back what Mr. Light stole from you." "I don't want it." "What?" No. I'm better off without it. I want nothing of them. Neither their blood nor their silver. I'll carry that hamper for you, Syl. Mr. Light can have the old cup. But your mother... She didn't like it either. He came back when he had left the hamper and stopped by the kitchen hearth. Syl had built up a little fire of faggots to heat water. He put his two hands on the mantelpiece and his forehead on his hands. He stood like that a long time. His grandfather had built this great house. His mother had played on the floor of this kitchen. Was it here his father had come? His father, the French doctor. Dr. Latour, the Bible had it. Here was mystery, surely. Why not Dr. Tremaine? And why had the Bible said both he and Lavinia Light died of plague in Marseille? 1758, 3 months before he himself had been born. Does it matter? Does it, or doesn't it? No. He answered his own question out loud and took from his pocket the heavy pages he had cut from the Bible, all written over with the names of his genealogy. He could not think now why he had ever cut them out. Slowly, tearing each sheet to ribbons, he fed them to the fire upon the hearth. Then Scylla was asking him to close and fasten all the heavy shutters through the house. This would protect the interior a little in spite of broken window panes. His footsteps echoed through the vast, silent reaches of the house. One after another, the heavy shutters slammed to, and he bolted them. A protest of unused hinges, and then a bang, and he went on to the next. The echo of his own footsteps. My grandfather built this house. My mother knew it and loved it. My father dead before ever I was born. Now, for as long as it stood, this would be a haunted house. He felt the ghosts waiting in darkness until he and Scylla were gone before they stepped forth to take possession. Merchant Light, soon enough, he too would be back here. Miss Lavinia? She might live to be 100, but the time would come when, wilt she or not, she must return to this house. This haunted house, with its thin wreath of wraiths and his mother's among them. He had seen her face, heard her voice so clearly that night he had lain on a grave on Copse Hill. He thought of her with a love and a tender understanding, an understanding he had been too young to give when she had died. But he left the haunted chambers, echoing halls, and went gladly to the kitchen where Scylla was. For the dead should not look at the living, nor the living too long upon the dead. Scylla, unaware of his emotions, looked about her with satisfaction. She had finished her work. Now it will be in good order when the lights come back. Johnny felt sad. He went to her and put his arms about her and his thin cheek against her hair. Scylla, they won't ever come back. Never? No. This is the end. The end of one thing, the beginning of something else. They won't come back because there's going to be a war. Civil war. And we'll win. First folk like them get routed out of Milton, then out of Boston. And the cards are going to be reshuffled. Dealt again. Shall I shutter the kitchen too? Yes. Each time a shutter groaned, protested, and then came to with a bang, it seemed to say, "This is the end," and the words echoed through the house. "This is the end. This is the end." My mother played on the floor of this kitchen. My grandfather was but a young man when he built this house, and I, a grandson, have better right to it, doubtless, than an elder brother. The house was still filled with midnight and ghosts, but as they closed and locked the heavy kitchen door behind them, they saw it was close upon dawn. "It is like a funeral," Scylla whispered, "only worse." so he knew that much of what he had been feeling, Scylla had also felt. Along down Old Country Road, marching through the meager half-light of the new day, came a company of Minutemen up and out early, drilling for coming battles before it was yet the hour to get to their chores. Left, right, left, right, left. They did not march too well. A boy no bigger than Dusty Miller had put a five to his lips, was trying to blow it. He made awkward little tootles. The men marched on past the defaced gates of the Light's country seat, never turning to look at them or Dr. Warren's chaise with Scylla and Johnny under the hood. Oh, God help them, thought Johnny. They haven't seen those British troops in Boston. I have. They haven't seen the gold lace on the generals, those muskets. Also alike, and everyone has a bayonet. They haven't seen. The chaise overtook and passed the marching farmers. 3. That musket which Rab did not have bothered Johnny. However, the soldiers never carried them while loitering about alehouses and wharves or the stables of the Afric Queen. They stood guard with them. They drilled with them. They practiced marksmanship, very badly, Rab said. And now and then, over at the foot of the common, they executed a deserter with them. But never, not once, as far as Johnny could make out, did they leave them about. Drilling, shooting, marching over, they stacked them at their barracks, and there was always at least a sergeant guarding these stacked guns. Johnny and Rab dropped their voices, even in the privacy of their attic, when they discussed these muskets. The Yankee gunsmiths were working from dawn to dusk preparing guns, making new ones. But as long as Rab had a weapon and was, after all, little more than a boy, he believed he had no chance for a modern gun unless he got it for himself from the British. "How soon?" Johnny whispered. "Before they march out and the war begins." "God knows," Rab murmured. "God and General Gage. Maybe not until next spring. Armies always move in the spring. But before then, I must have a good gun in my hands. A man can stand up to anything with a good weapon in his hands. Without it, he's but a dumb beast." Johnny had never seen Rab so blocked by anything. Apparently, he went through every situation without friction, like a knife going through cheese. Now he was blocked, and it made him restless, possibly less canny. One day he told Johnny that he had a contract with a farmer from Medway, who was making a business of buying muskets from the British privates and selling them to Minutemen. Rab did not like to ask his aunt for so large a sum. She had little enough to buy food, but she had said, "Weapons before food." One morning Johnny knew Rab was meeting the farmer at market. He knew that the soldier returning from guard duty was going, absent-mindedly, to leave his musket on a pile of straw. It had all been worked out. But when he heard yells and shouts from the marketplace and the rattle of British drums calling up reserves, he tore over to Dock Square. He had a feeling that the turmoil was over Rab's gun. He was right. A solid block of redcoats faced out, presenting their muskets at the market people and inhabitants. The captain was yelling to the churning hundreds, "Get back! Stand back! Good people of Boston, this is our own private affair!" "What's happened?" Johnny asked an old henwife. "They'd caught one of their own men selling a musket to a farmer. Happens he comes from Medway?" "So, 'tis said." "Happens they caught more than the farmer and the soldier?" "They caught three in all. They are taking them over to the province house for General Gage."
"Gage is in Salem."
"For some colonel, then."
No mob gathered to rescue the two Yankees. All, by now, felt a certain confidence in the British way of doing things. A general, or even a colonel, had the right to punish a soldier caught selling his arms, and also anyone who tempted him. Johnny tagged the marching soldiers, but it was not until they turned into the province house that he saw the three prisoners. The British soldier was grinning, and Johnny guessed that he had been put up to this game merely to snare the yokels. The farmer was in his market smock. He had long, straight gray hair and a thin, mean mouth. You could tell by looking at him he had gone into this little business for the love of money, not for the love of freedom.
Rab had been shaken out of his usual nice balance between quick action and caution by his passionate desire for a good gun. Otherwise, he would not have mixed himself up with such a man. Rab himself was looking a little sullen. He was not used to defeat. What would they do to him? They might imprison him. They might flog him. Worst of all, they might turn him over to some tough top sergeant to be taught a lesson. This informal punishment would doubtless be the worst. The province house was a beautiful building, and as Johnny hung about the front of it, he had a chance to admire it for over an hour. It stood well back from the rattle and bustle of Marlborough Street, with its glassy-eyed copper Indian on the top of the cupola, and its carved and colored lion and unicorn of Britain over the door. Behind the house he heard orders called, and soldiers were hallooing. But worst of all, they were laughing. And that was Colonel Nesbitt's boy bringing around the colonel's charger. There was a large group of people still standing in the street. The hilarity of the British soldiers did not ease their fears as to the fate of the prisoners. Johnny could hear the rattle of the men's muskets as they came to attention, and then, altogether, four drummers let their sticks fall as one. Out onto Marlborough Street, with the drummers in black bearskin caps first, and then Colonel Nesbitt on horseback, came almost the entire 47th Regiment surrounding a cart. In the cart sat a hideous black bird, big as a man, shaped like a man, with head hung forward like a molting crow. It was a naked man, painted with tar and rolled in feathers. Three times already the Whigs had tarred and feathered enemies and carted them through the streets of Boston. Now it was the British turn. The redcoats marched. The colonel's horse pranced. The cart with its shameful burden bumped over cobbles. One glance had convinced Johnny this was not Rab. The hideous blackbird had a paunch. Rab had none. Before the townhouse, Colonel Nesbitt ordered a halt, and an orderly came forward and read a proclamation. It merely explained what was being done and why, and threatened like treatment to the next buyer of stolen weapons. Then Colonel Nesbitt was evidently a newspaper reader. The regiment went to Marshall Lane and stopped before the office of the Spy. The threat was made that the editor of that paper would soon be treated like the bird in the cart. Then they were heading for Eads and Gill's office. Johnny guessed the Observer would come next after the Boston Gazette, and ran to Salt Lane to warn Uncle Lorne. He jumped into the shop, slamming the door after him, looking wildly about for the printer. Rab, in his printer's apron, was standing at his bench, quietly setting type. "Rab! How did you do it? How'd you get away?" Rab's eyes glittered. In spite of his great air of calm, he was angry. "Colonel Nesbitt said I was just a child." "Go buy a popgun, boy," he said. "They flung me out the back door. Told me to go home." Then Johnny laughed. He couldn't help it. Rab had always, as far as Johnny knew, been treated as a grown man and always looked upon himself as such. So, all he did was hurt your feelings? Rab grinned suddenly, but a little thinly. Johnny told of the tar and feathering of the farmer, and also that he expected in a short time the 47th Regiment would come marching down Salt Lane and stop before the door to read that proclamation about tar and feathering seditious newspaper publishers. "And here they come, those dressed-up red monkeys. But they don't dare do anything but stop, read a proclamation, and move on." When this was over and the troops moved on down the lane to Union, Johnny and Rab stood in the street and watched them. "Luckily," said Rab, "I didn't give my money in advance. I'll return it to Aunt Jennifer." But he still stood in the street watching the stiff rhythm of the marching troops, the glitter of their guns and bayonets, the dazzle of the white and scarlet disappearing at the bottom of the lane. "They'll make good targets, all right," he said absent-mindedly. "Out in Lexington, they are telling us, pick off the officers first, then the sergeants. Those white crosses on their chests are easy to sight on." His words frightened Johnny a little. Lieutenant Stranger, Sergeant Gale, Major Pitcairn. Johnny could not yet think of them as targets. Rab could. 4. Back of the lighthouse were apple trees, now heavy with fruit. Johnny and Scylla sat together on a bench. He had missed her that month she had been out in Milton. It was still summer, but everywhere you could smell and feel the coming of fall. It had been an interesting conversation. Madge had run off and married Sergeant Gale, and Ma had been so put to it to keep Mr. Tweedy in the family she had married him herself. "She said he was too old for me, and she knows he's too young for her, but he's a clever smith, and she's going to hang on to him, come hell and high water." Scylla bent her face over the work in her lap. She was rolling a tiny ham on a tiny handkerchief. One of Miss Lavinia's. "So, she's Mrs. Tweedy now?" "Yes, Maria Tweedy. That's not so bad. You know, you have to marry someone whose last name goes with your first. For instance, if my name was Rue, I couldn't marry a man named Barb. Or if my name happened to be Tobacco, I couldn't marry a man named Pouch or Pipe or..."
"Nobody was ever named Tobacco."
"Well, you don't know. If a southern merchant made a lot of money on tobacco, I think he might name his daughter Tobacco.
We make money on codfish around here, and I never heard anyone calling his girl Codfish. You're just being silly."
"But I like to be silly. I like to plan things out. For instance, I couldn't marry a man called..."
"Anybody called Priscilla can marry anybody."
"No, they can't. For instance, I couldn't marry Rab."
Johnny froze. From being mildly irritated but interested, he was a little angry.
"Nobody asked you to," he said shortly.
"I know, but a girl has to think about things like that. Almost anything can happen to a girl, suddenly, and she has to think ahead so she'll know which way to jump."
"Rab wouldn't marry you. He's too
wonderful."
Scylla gave him one of her sweet veiled glances out of the corner of her eye.
"That's what you mean?"
It was exactly what Johnny had meant.
"Of course not. But he's not like any other boy I ever knew."
Scylla did not look at the work in her idle fingers. She stared off down Beacon Hill. From where they sat, they could see the ocean.
"I know that. But when you get to really know him, he doesn't seem so wonderful. I mean, he's just as wonderful, but a whole lot nicer."
Johnny did not want to ask the next question, but he could not help it.
How'd you get to know him so well?"
She looked surprised.
"Why, he comes here and takes me walking and buys me sweets, and once he took me to Old South to hear Dr. Warren."
Rab had never said anything about this to Johnny. It was well enough to say Rab was secretive by nature and couldn't help the way God had made him. But Johnny felt piqued. Scylla noticed the shadow on his face.
"Priscilla Silsby is poor, but Scylla Silsby is worse."
Johnny's lower lip stuck out. Seemingly without any action of the wind, his fair hair was rumpled all over his head.
"But Priscilla Tremaine is a fine name," she went on.
"I've thought about that ever since you came to the shop and Mother told me I had to marry you.
I was 11 then."
Then they had both been 11. She a skinny little thing with a gentle face and a disturbing tongue. Her clothes had always been too big for her because they were handed down from Dorcas. She had had to pin her skirts tight about her waist to keep them on. Pretty and shabby, and sweet and sour. Johnny had liked her right off. He had not thought much about what she looked like now. But he looked at her as she bent her face to her work. The little pointed chin settled into the fresh white ruffles about her throat. Somehow her hair was curly around the edges and straight everywhere else. She had a shallow little nose, and on either side of the bridge lay those long lashes which could mock him as well as her tongue. And so pretty, he could not believe it. He was accustomed to staring at Lavinia Light's famous beauty, and to feel a pleasant tingle up and down his spine. And now it was Scylla Lapham, just good old Scylla, that was giving him the spinal creeps. When he was 11, he said he would marry her, if he had to. And when he was 14, he had said he wouldn't take her on a gold platter. He was 15 now. and soon he would be a grown-up man going courting like Rab. Scylla was packing up her sewing. Miss Lavinia will be wanting her tea, and I'm